Walking back to the Chamberlain King Franklin complex of dorms, I took her hand almost without thinking about it. She curled her fingers through mine naturally enough, but I thought I could feel a reserve now. "Are you going to go back for the Kane Mutiny?" she asked. "You could if you still got your ticket stub, or I could give you mine." "Nah, I've got geology to study." "Bet you wind up playing cards all night instead." "I can't afford to," I said, and I meant it. I meant to go back and study. I really did. "Lonely Struggles, or A Scholarship Boy's Life," Carol said. "A heartbreaking novel by Charles Dickens. You'll weep as plucky Peter Riley throws himself into the river after finding that the Financial Aid Office has revoked his grant package." I laughed. She was very sharp. "I'm in the same boat, you know. If we screw up, maybe we can make it a double suicide. Into the Penobscot with us. Goodbye, cruel world." "What's a Connecticut girl doing at the University of Maine anyway?" I asked. "That's a little complicated. And if you ever plan on asking me out again, you should know you're robbing the cradle. I won't actually be 18 until November. I skipped the 7th grade. That was the year my parents got divorced, and I was miserable. It was either study all the time or turn into one of the Harwich Junior High corner girls. They're the ones who major in French kissing and usually wind up pregnant at 16. You know the kind I mean?" "Sure. In Gates, you saw them in giggling little groups outside Frank's Fountain or the Dairy Delish, waiting for the boys to come by in their drop Fords and Plymouth Hemis, fast cars with the fender skirts and the decals saying Fram and Quaker State in the back windows. You could see those girls as women down at the other end of Main Street, 10 years older and 40 pounds heavier, drinking beers and shots in Chucky's Tavern. I turned into a study grind. My father was in the Navy. He got out on a disability and moved here to Maine, Damariscotta, down on the coast." I nodded, thinking of Diane Renee's steady boy, the one who said ship ahoy and joined the Navy. "I was living in Connecticut with my mother and going to Harwich High. I applied to 16 different schools and got accepted by all but three, but they expected you to pay your own way, and you couldn't." She nodded. "I think I missed the Plum scholarships by maybe 20 SAT points. An extracurricular activity or two probably wouldn't have hurt either, but I was too busy grinding away at the books. And by then I was pretty hot and heavy with Sully John. The boyfriend, right?" She nodded, but not as though this Sully John interested her. The only two schools offering realistic financial aid packages were Maine and UConn. I decided on Maine because by then I wasn't getting along very well with my mother. Lots of fights. "You get along better with your father?" "Hardly ever see him," she said in a dry, business-like tone. "He lives with this woman who, well, they drink a lot and fight a lot. Let's leave it at that. But he's a resident of the state, I'm his daughter, and this is a land-grant college. I didn't get everything I needed. UConn offered the better deal, frankly, but I'm not afraid of a little work. It's worth it just to get away." She took a deep breath of the night air and let it out, faintly white. We were almost back to Franklin. Inside the lobby, I could see guys sitting in the hard plastic contour chairs, waiting for their girls to come down from upstairs. It looked like quite a rogues gallery. "Worth it just to get away," she had said. Did that mean the mother, the town, and the high school, or was the boyfriend included? When we got to the wide double doors at the front of her dorm, I put my arms around her and bent to kiss her again. She put her hands on my chest, stopping me. Not pulling back, just stopping me. She looked up into my face, smiling that little smile of hers. I could get to love that smile, I thought. It was the kind of smile you might wake up thinking of in the middle of the night. The blue eyes and the blonde hair, too, but mostly the smile. The lips only curved a little, but the corners of the mouth deepened to dimples all the same. "My boyfriend's real name is John Sullivan," she said, "like the fighter. Now tell me the name of your girlfriend." "Anne Marie," I said, not much caring for the sound of it as it came out of my mouth. Anne Marie Susie. She's a senior at Gates Falls High this year. I let Carol go. When I did, she took her hands off my chest and grabbed mine. This is information, she said. Information, that's all. Still want to kiss me? I nodded. I wanted to more than ever. Okay. She tilted her face up, closed her eyes, opened her lips a little. She looked like a kid waiting at the foot of the stairs for her goodnight kiss from Papa. It was so cute, I almost laughed. Instead, I bent and kissed her. She kissed back with pleasure and enthusiasm. There were no tongues touching, but it was a thorough, searching kiss just the same. When she drew back, her cheeks were flushed and her eyes were bright. Good night. Thanks for the movie. Want to do it again? I have to think about that, she said. She was smiling, but her eyes were serious. I suppose her boyfriend was on her mind. I know that Anne Marie was on mine. Maybe you better, too. I'll see you on the dish line Monday. What do you have? Lunch and dinner. I have breakfast and lunch, so I'll see you at lunch. Eat more main beans, I said. That made her laugh. She went inside. I watched her go, standing outside with my collar turned up and my hands in my pockets and a cigarette between my lips, feeling like Bogey. I watched her say something to the girl on the reception desk and then hurry upstairs, still laughing. I walked back to Chamberlain in the moonlight, determined to get serious about the geosyncline. I only went into the third floor lounge to get my geology book. I swear it's true. When I got there, every table, plus one or two which must have been hijacked from other floors, was occupied by a quartet of hearts-playing fools. There was even a group in the corner, sitting cross-legged on the floor and staring intently at their cards. They looked like half-assed yogis. "We chasing the cunt!" Ronnie Malenfant yelled to the room at large. "We gotta bust that bitch out, boys!" I picked up my geology text from the sofa where it had lain all day and night. Someone had sat on it, pushing it most of the way down between two cushions, but that baby was too big to hide entirely. And looked at it the way you might look at some artifact of unknown purpose. In Hauk Auditorium, sitting beside Carol Gerber, this crazy card party had seemed like a dream. Now it was Carol who seemed dreamlike. Carol with her dimples and her boyfriend with a boxer's name. I still had $6 in my pocket, and it was absurd to feel disappointed just because there was no place for me in any of the games currently going on. Study, that was what I had to do, make friends with the geosyncline. I'd camp out in the second floor lounge or maybe find a quiet corner in the basement rec. Just as I was leaving with historical geology under my arm, Kirby McClendon tossed down his cards and cried, "Fuck this! I'm tapped, all because I keep getting hit with that fucking Queen of Spades. I'll give you guys IOUs, but I am honest to God tapped out." He went out past me without looking back, ducking his head as he went through the door. I've always thought that being that tall must be a kind of curse. A month later, Kirby would be tapped out in a much larger sense, withdrawn from the university by his frightened parents after a mental breakdown and a half-assed suicide attempt. Not the first victim of Hart's mania that fall, nor the last, but the only one to try and off himself by eating 2 bottles of orange-flavored baby aspirin. Lenny Doria didn't even bother looking after him. He looked over at me instead. "You want to sit in, Riley?" A brief but perfectly genuine struggle for my soul went on. I needed to study. I had planned on studying, and for a financial aid boy like me, that was a good plan, certainly more sensible than sitting here in this smoky room and adding the effluent from my own Pall Malls to the general fug. So I said, "Yeah, why not?" and sat down and played hearts until almost 1 in the morning. When I finally shambled back to my room, Nate was lying on his bed reading his Bible. That was the last thing he did every night before going to sleep. This was his 3rd trip through what he always called the Word of God, he told me. He'd reached the book of Nehemiah. He looked up at me with an expression of calm inquiry, a look that never changed much. Now that I think about it, Nate never changed much. He was in pre-dent, and he stayed with it. Tucked into his last Christmas card to me was a photo of his new office in Holton. In the photo, there are three magi standing around a straw-filled cradle on the snowy office lawn. Behind Mary and Joseph, you can read the sign on the door. Nathaniel Hoppenstand, DDS. He married Cindy. They are still married, and their three children are mostly grown up. I imagine Rinty died and got replaced. "Did you win?" Nate asked. He spoke in almost the same tone of voice my wife would use some years later when I came home half-drunk after a Thursday night poker game. Actually, I did. I had gravitated to a table where Ronnie was playing and had lost three of my remaining $6, then drifted to another one where I won them back, and a couple of more besides. But I had never gotten around to the geosyncline or the mysteries of tectonic plates. Nate was wearing red and white striped pajamas. He was, I think, the only person I ever shared a room with in college, male or female, who wore pajamas. Of course, he was also the only one who owned Diane Renee Sings Navy Blue. As I began undressing, Nate slipped between the covers of his bed and reached behind him to turn off the study lamp on his desk. "Got your geology all studied up?" he asked as the shadow swallowed his half of the room. "I'm in good shape with it," I said. Years later, when I came in from those late poker games and my wife would ask me how drunk I was, I'd say, "I only had a couple," in that same chipper tone of voice. I swung into my own bed, turned off my own light, and was asleep almost immediately. I dreamed I was playing hearts. Ronnie Malenfant was dealing. Stoke Jones stood in the lounge doorway, hunched over his crutches and eyeing me, eyeing all of us, with the dour disapproval of a Massachusetts Bay Colony Puritan. In my dream, there was an enormous amount of money lying on the table, hundreds of dollars in crumpled fives and ones, money orders, even a personal check or two. I looked at this, then back at the doorway. Carol Gerber was now standing on one side of Stokely. Nate, dressed in his candy cane pajamas, was on the other side. "We want information," Carol said. "You won't get it," I replied. In the TV show, that was always Patrick McGoohan's reply to number two. Nate said, "You left your window open, Pete. The room's cold and your paper's blue everywhere." I couldn't think of an adequate reply to this, so I picked up the hand I'd been dealt and fanned it open. 13 cards, and every one was the Queen of Spades. Every one was La Femme Noire. Every one was the bitch. In Vietnam, the war was going well. Lyndon Johnson, on a swing through the South Pacific, said so. There were a few minor setbacks, however. The Viet Cong shot down three American Hueys practically in Saigon's backyard. A little further out from Big S, an estimated 1,000 Viet Cong soldiers kicked the shit out of at least twice that number of South Vietnamese regulars. In the Mekong Delta, U.S. gunships sank 120 Viet Cong River Patrol boats, which turned out to contain, whoops, large numbers of refugee children. America lost its 400th plane of the war that October, an F-105 Thunder Chief. The pilot parachuted to safety. In Manila, South Vietnam's Prime Minister, Nguyen Cao Ky, insisted that he was not a crook. Neither were the members of his cabinet, he said, and the fact that a dozen or so cabinet members resigned while Ky was in the Philippines was just coincidence. In San Diego, Bob Hope did a show for Army boys headed in-country. "I wanted to call Bing and send him along with you," Bob said, "but that pipe-smoking son of a gun has unlisted his number." The Army boys roared with laughter. Question Mark and the Mysterians ruled the radio. Their song, 96 Tears, was a monster hit. They never had another one. In Honolulu, hula hula girls greeted President Johnson. At the UN, Secretary General U Thant was pleading with American Representative Arthur Goldberg to stop, at least temporarily, the bombing of North Vietnam. Arthur Goldberg got in touch with the Great White Father in Hawaii to relay Thant's request. The Great White Father, perhaps still wearing his lei, said, "No way. We'd stop when the Viet Cong stopped. But in the meantime, they were going to cry 96 tears. At least 96. Johnson did a brief, clumsy shimmy with the Hula Hula Girls. I remember watching that on the Huntley-Brinkley Report and thinking he danced like every other white guy I knew, which was, incidentally, all the guys I knew. In Greenwich Village, a peace march was broken up by the police. The marchers had no permit, the police said. In San Francisco, war protesters carrying plastic skulls on sticks and wearing whiteface like a troop of mimes were dispersed by tear gas. In Denver, police tore down thousands of posters advertising an anti-war rally at Chautauqua Park in Boulder. The police had discovered a statute forbidding the posting of such bills. The statute did not, the Denver chief said, forbid posted bills which advertised movies, old clothes drives, VFW dances, or rewards for information leading to the recovery of lost pets. Those posters, the chief explained, were not political. On our own little patch, there was a sit-in at East Annex, where Coleman Chemicals was holding job interviews. Coleman, like Dow, made napalm. Coleman also made Agent Orange, botulin compound, and anthrax, it turned out, although no one knew that until the company went bankrupt in 1980. In the main campus, there was a small picture of the protesters being led away. A larger photo showed one protester being pulled out of the East Annex doorway by a campus cop, while another cop stood by, holding the protester's crutches, said protester was Stoke Jones, of course, wearing his duffel coat with the sparrow track on the back. The cops were treating him kindly enough, I'm sure. At that point, war protesters were still more novelty than nuisance. But the combination of the big cop and the staggering boy made the picture creepy somehow. I thought of it many times between 1968 and 1971. Years when, in the words of Bob Dylan, the game got rough. The largest photo in that issue, the only one above the fold, showed ROTC guys in uniform marching on the sunny football field while large crowds watched. "Maneuvers draw a record crowd," read the headline. Closer to home still, one Peter Riley got a D on his geology quiz and a D-plus on a sociology quiz 2 days later. On Friday, I got back a one-page essay of opinion I had scribbled just before intro English writing on Monday morning. The subject was, ties should not be required for men in restaurants. I had chosen should not. This little expository exercise had been marked with a big red C, the first C I'd gotten in English since arriving at U of M with my straight A's in high school English and my 740 score on the SAT verbals. That red hook shocked me in a way the quiz D's hadn't, and angered me as well. Across the top, Mr. Babcock had written, "Your usual clarity is present, but in this case serves only to show what a meatless meal this is. Your humor, although facile, falls far short of wit. The sea is actually something of a gift. Sloppy work." I thought of approaching him after class, then rejected the idea. Mr. Babcock, who wore bow ties and big horn-rimmed glasses, had made it clear in just 4 weeks that he considered grade grubbers the lowest form of academic life. Also, it was noon. If I grabbed a quick bite at the Palace on the Plains, I could be back on Chamberlain 3 by 1. All the tables in the lounge and all four corners of the room would be filled by 3 o'clock that afternoon, but at 1 I'd still be able to find a seat. I was almost $20 to the good by then and planned to spend a profitable late October weekend lining my pockets. I was also planning on the Saturday night dance at Lengel Gym. Carol had agreed to go with me. The Cumberlands, a popular campus group, were playing. At some point, more likely at several points, they would do their version of 96 Tears. The voice of conscience, already speaking in the tones of Nate Hoppenstand, suggested I'd do well to spend at least part of the weekend hitting the books. I had 2 chapters of geology to read, 2 chapters of sociology, 40 pages of history, the Middle Ages at a gulp, plus a set of questions to answer concerning trade routes. "I'll get to it. Don't worry, I'll get to it," I told that voice. "Sunday's my day to study. You can count on it. You can take it to the bank." And for a while on Sunday, I actually did read about in-groups, out-groups, and group sanctions. Between hands of cards, I read about them. Then things got interesting, and my soch book ended up on the floor under the couch. Going to bed on Sunday night, late Sunday night, it occurred to me that not only had my winning shrunk instead of grown, Ronnie now seemed actually to be seeking me out, but I hadn't really gotten very far with my studying. Also, I hadn't made a certain phone call. "If you really want to put your hand there," Carol said, and she had been smiling that funny little smile when she said it, that smile which was mostly dimples and a look in the eyes. "If you really want to put your hand there." About halfway through the Saturday night dance, she and I had gone out for a smoke. It was a mild night, and along Lingle's brick north side, maybe 20 couples were hugging and kissing by the light of the moon rising over Chadbourne Hall. Carol and I joined them. Before long, I had my hand inside her sweater. I rubbed my thumb over the smooth cotton of her bra cup, feeling the stiff little rise of her nipple. My temperature was also rising. I could feel hers rising as well. She looked into my face with her arms still locked around my neck and said, "If you really want to put your hand there, I think you owe somebody a phone call, don't you?" "There's time," I told myself as I drifted toward sleep. "There's plenty of time for studying, plenty of time for phone calls, plenty of time." Skip Kirk blew an anthropology quiz, ended up guessing at half of the answers and getting a 58. He got a C- on an advanced calc quiz and only did that well because his last math course in high school had covered some of the same concepts. We were in the same sociology course and he got a D- on the quiz, scoring a bare 70. And we weren't the only ones with problems. Ronnie was a winner at hearts, better than $50 up in 10 days of play, if you believed him. No one completely did, although we knew he was winning. But a loser in his classes. He flunked a French quiz, blew off the little English paper in the class we shared. "Who gives a fuck about ties? I eat at McDonald's," he said. And scraped through a quiz in some other history division by scanning an admirer's notes just before class. Kirby McClendon had quit shaving and began gnawing his fingernails between deals. He also began cutting significant numbers of classes. Jack Frady convinced his advisor to let him drop Statistics 1, even though ad drop was officially over. "I cried a little," he told me matter-of-factly one night in the lounge as we bitch-hunted our way toward the wee hours. "It's something I learned to do in dramatics club." Lenny Doria tapped on my door a couple of nights later while I was cramming. Nate had been in the rack for an hour or more, sleeping the sleep of the just and the caught up, and asked me if I had any interest in writing a paper about Crispus Atticus. He had heard I could do such things. He'd pay a fair price, Lenny said. He was currently $10 up in the game. I said I was sorry, but I couldn't help him. I was behind a couple of papers myself. Lenny nodded and slipped out. Ashley Rice broke out in horrible, oozing acne all over his face. Mark St. Pierre had a sleepwalking interlude after losing almost $20 in one catastrophic night, and Brad Witherspoon got into a fight with a guy on the first floor. The guy made some innocuous little crack. Later on, Brad himself admitted it had been innocuous. But Brad, who'd just been hit with the bitch 3 times in 4 hands and only wanted a Coke out of the first-floor machine to soothe his butt-parched throat, wasn't in an innocuous mood. He turned, dropped his unopened soda into the sandwell of a nearby cigarette urn, and started punching. Broke the kid's glasses, loosened one of his teeth. So Brad Witherspoon, ordinarily about as dangerous as a library mimeograph, was the first of us to go on disciplinary pro. I thought about calling Anne Marie and telling her I had met someone and was dating, but it seemed like a lot of work, a lot of psychic effort on top of everything else. I settled for hoping that she'd write me a letter saying that she thought it was time we started seeing other people. Instead, I got one saying how much she missed me and that she was making me something special for Christmas, which probably meant a sweater, one with reindeer on it. Reindeer sweaters were an Anne Marie specialty. Those slow, stroking hand jobs were another. She enclosed a picture of herself in a short skirt. Looking at it made me feel not horny, but tired and guilty and put upon. Carol also made me feel put upon. I had wanted a cop a feel, that was all, not change my whole fucking life, or hers, for that matter. But I liked her, that was true. A lot. That smile of hers and her sharp wit. This is getting good, she had said. We're exchanging information like mad. A week or so later, I returned from Holyoke, where I'd worked lunch with her on the dish line, and saw Frank Stewart walking slowly down the third-floor hallway with his trunk hung from his hands. Frank was from western Maine, one of those little unincorporated townships that are practically all trees, and had a Yankee accent so thick you could slice it. He was just a so-so Hearts player, usually ducking in second or a close third when somebody else went over the 100-point mark, but a hell of a nice guy. He always had a smile on his face, at least until the afternoon I came upon him headed for the stairwell with his trunk. "You moving rooms, Frank?" I asked. But even then I thought I knew better. It was in the look on his face, serious and pale and downcast. He shook his head. "Going back home. Got a letter from my ma. She says they need a caretaker at one of those big lake resorts we got over our way. I said, sure, I'm just wasting my time here." "You are not," I said, a little shocked. "Christ, Frankie, you're getting a college education." "I ain't, though, that's the thing." The hall was gloomy and choked with shadows. It was raining outside. Still, I think I saw color come flushing into Frank's cheeks. I think he was ashamed. I think that was why he'd arranged to leave in the middle of a weekday, when the dorm was at its emptiest. "I ain't doing nothing but playing cards. Not very well, either. Also, I'm behind in all my classes."
"You can't be that far behind. It's only October 25th.
Frank nodded. "I know, but I ain't quick like some. Wasn't quick in high school, either. I got to set my feet and bore in like with an ice auger. I ain't been doing it, and if you ain't got a hole in the ice, you can't catch any perch. I'm going, Pete. Gonna quit before they fire me in January."
He went on, plodding down the first of the 3 flights with his trunk held in front of him by the handles. His white T-shirt floated in the gloom. When he passed a window running with rain, his crew-cut glimmered like gold. As he reached the second-floor landing and his footfalls began to take on an echoey beat, I rushed to the stairwell and looked down.
"Frankie! Hey, Frank!"
The footfalls stopped. In the shadows, I could see his round face looking up at me and the dim-held shape of his trunk.
"Frank, what about the draft? If you drop out of school, the draft'll get you."
A long pause, as if he was thinking how to answer. He never did, not with his mouth. He answered with his feet. Their echoey sound resumed. I never saw Frank again. I remember standing by the stairwell, scared, thinking, that could happen to me. Maybe is happening to me. Then pushing the thought away. Seeing Frank with his trunk was a warning, I decided, and I would heed it. I would do better. I had been coasting, and it was time to turn on the jets again. But from down the hall, I could hear Ronnie yelling gleefully that he was bitch hunting, that he meant to have that whore out of hiding. And I decided I would do better starting tonight. Tonight would be time enough to relight those fabled jets. This afternoon, I'd play my farewell game of hearts. Or two. Or 40. It was years before I isolated the key part of my final conversation with Frank Stewart. I had told him he couldn't be so far behind so soon, and he had replied that it happened because he wasn't a quick study. We were both wrong. It was possible to fall catastrophically behind in a short period of time, and it happened to the quick studies like me and Skip and Mark St. Pierre, as well as to the plodders. In the backs of our minds, we must have been holding on to the idea that we'd be able to loaf and then spurt, loaf and then spurt, which was the way most of us had gone through our dozy hometown high schools. But as Deary Dearborn had pointed out, this wasn't high school. I told you that of the 32 students who began the fall semester on our floor of Chamberlain, 33 if you count Deary, but he was immune to the charms of hearts. Only 15 remained to start the spring semester. That doesn't mean the 19 who left were all dopes, though, not by any means. In fact, the smartest fellows on Chamberlain 3 in the fall of 1966 were probably the ones who transferred before flunking out became a real possibility. Steve Ogg and Jack Frady, who had the room just up the hall from Nate and me, went to Chadbourne the first week in November, citing distractions on their joint application. When the housing officer asked what sort of distractions, they said it was the usual. All-night bull sessions, toothpaste ambushes in the head, abrasive relations with a couple of the guys. As an afterthought, both added they were probably playing cards in the lounge a little too much. They'd heard Chad was a quieter environment, one of the campus's two or three brain dorms. The housing officer's question had been anticipated. The answer is carefully rehearsed as an oral presentation in a speech class. Neither Steve nor Jack wanted the nearly endless hearts games shut down. That might cause them all sorts of grief from people who believed folks should mind their own business. All they wanted was to get the fuck off Chamberlain 3 while there was still time to salvage their scholarships. The bad quizzes and unsuccessful little papers were nothing but unpleasant skirmishes. For Skip and me and too many of our card-playing buddies, our second round of prelims was a full-fledged disaster. I got an A- on my in-class English theme and a D in European history, but flunked the sociology multiple-choicer and the geology multiple-choicer, soc by a little and geo by a lot. Skip flunked his anthropology prelim, his colonial history prelim, and the soc prelim. He got a C on the calculus test, but the ice was getting pretty thin there, too, he told me, and a B on his in-class essay. We agreed that life would be much simpler if it were all a matter of in-class essays, writing assignments which necessarily took place far from the third-floor lounge. We were wishing for high school, in other words, without even knowing it. "Okay, that's enough," Skip said to me that Friday night. "I'm buckling down, Peter. I don't give a shit about being a college man or having a diploma to hang over the mantle in my rumpus room, but I'll be fucked if I want to go back to Dexter and hang around fucking Bolarama with the rest of the retards until Uncle Sam calls me." He was sitting on Nate's bed. Nate was across the way at the Palace on the Plains, chowing down on Friday night fish. It was nice to know somebody on Chamberlain 3 had an appetite. This was a conversation we couldn't have around Nate in any case. My country mouse roommate thought he'd done pretty well on the latest round of prelims, all C's and B's. He wouldn't have said anything if he'd heard us talking, but would have looked at us in a way that said we lacked gumption, that, although it might not be our fault, we were morally weak. "I'm with you," I said, And then, from down the hall, came an agonized cry. Oh, fuck me! That we recognized instantly. Someone had just taken the bitch. Our eyes met. I can't say about Skip, not for sure, even though he was my best friend in college, but I was still thinking that there was time. And why wouldn't I think that? For me, there always had been. Skip began to grin. I began to grin. Skip began to giggle. I began to giggle right along with him. What the fuck, he said. Just tonight, I said. We'll go over to the library together tomorrow. Hit the books. All day, but right now. He stood up. Let's go bitch hunting. We did. And we weren't the only ones. That's no explanation, I know. It's only what happened. At breakfast the next morning, as we worked side by side on the dish line, Carol said, I'm hearing there's some kind of big card game going on in your dorm. Is that true? I guess it is, I said. She looked at me over her shoulder, giving me that smile, the one I always thought about when I thought about Carol, the one I think about still. Hearts? Hunting the bitch? Hearts, I agreed, hunting the bitch. I heard that some guys are getting in over their heads, getting in grades trouble. I guess that might be, I said. Nothing was coming down the conveyor belt, not so much as a single tray. There's never a rush when you need one, I've noticed. How are your grades? She asked. I know it's none of my business, but I want... information. Yeah, I know. I'm doing okay. Besides, I'm getting out of the game. She gave me the smile, and sure, I still think about it sometimes. You would, too. The dimples, the slightly curved lower lip that knew so many nice things about kissing, the dancing blue eyes. Those were days when no girl saw further into a boy's dorm than the lobby, and vice versa, of course. Still, I have an idea that for a little while in October and November of 1966, Carol saw plenty, more than I did. But of course, she wasn't insane. At least, not then. The war in Vietnam became her insanity. Mine as well, and Skip's, and Nate's. Hearts were nothing, really, only a few tremors in the earth, the kind that flapped the screen door on its hinges and rattled the glasses on the shelves. The killer earthquake, the apocalyptic continent drowner, was still on its way. Barry Margot and Brad Witherspoon both got the Dairy News delivered to their rooms, and the two copies had usually made the rounds of the third floor by the end of the day. We'd find the remnants in the lounge when we took our seats for the evening session of Hearts, the pages torn and out of order, the crossword filled in by three or four different hands. There would be mustaches inked on the photo dot faces of Lyndon Johnson and Ramsey Clark and Martin Luther King. Someone, I never found out who, would invariably put large smoking horns on Vice President Humphrey and print Hubert the Devil underneath in tiny anal capital letters. The news was hawkish on the war, putting the most positive spin on each day's military events and relegating any protest news to the depths, usually beneath the community calendar. Yet more and more, we found ourselves discussing not movies or dates or classes as the cards were shuffled and dealt. More and more, it was Vietnam. No matter how good the news or how high the Kong body count, there always seemed to be at least one picture of agonized U.S. soldiers after an ambush or crying Vietnamese children watching their village go up in smoke. There was always some unsettling detail tucked away near the bottom of what Skip called the Daily Kill column, like the thing about the kids who got wasted when we hit the Kong PT boats in the Delta. Nate, of course, didn't play cards. He wouldn't debate the pros and cons of the war, either. I doubt if he knew, any more than I did, that Vietnam had once been under the French, or what had happened to the Messieurs, unlucky enough to have been in the fortress city of Dien Bien Phu in 1954, let alone who might have decided it was time for President Diem to go to that big rice paddy in the sky so that Nguyen Cao Ky and the generals could take over. Nate only knew that he had no quarrel with those Kongs, that they weren't going to be in Mars Hill or Presque Isle in the immediate future. "Haven't you ever heard about the domino theory, shitbird?" a bandy little freshman named Nicholas Prouty asked Nate one afternoon. My roommate rarely came down to the third-floor lounge now, preferring the quieter one on two, but that day he had dropped in for a few moments. Nate looked at Nick Prouty, a lobsterman's son who had become a devout disciple of Ronnie Malenfant, and sighed. "When the dominoes come out, I leave the room. I think it's a boring game. That's my domino theory." He shot me a glance. I got my eyes away as fast as I could, but not quite in time to avoid the message. "What in hell's wrong with you?" Then he left, scuffing back down to room 302 in his fuzzy slippers to do some more studying, to resume his charted course from pre-dent to dent, in other words. "Riley, your roommate's fucked, you know that?" Ronnie said. He had a cigarette tucked in the corner of his mouth. Now he scratched a match one-handed, a specialty of his. College guys too ugly and abrasive to get girls have all sorts of specialties, and lit up. "No, man," I thought. "Nate's doing fine. We're the ones who are fucked up." For a second, I felt real despair. In that second, I realized I was in a terrible jam and had no idea at all of how to extricate myself. I was aware of Skip looking at me, and it occurred to me that if I snatched up the cards, sprayed them in Ronnie's face, and walked out of the room, Skip would join me, likely with relief. Then the feeling passed. It passed as rapidly as it had come. "Nate's okay," I said. "He's got some funny ideas, that's all." "Some funny communist ideas is what he's got," Hugh Brennan said. His older brother was in the Navy and most recently heard from in the South China Sea. Hugh had no use for peaceniks. As a Goldwater Republican, I should have felt the same, but Nate had started getting to me. I had all sorts of canned knowledge, but no real arguments in favor of the war, nor time to work any up. I was too busy to study my sociology, let alone to bone up on U.S. foreign policy. I'm pretty sure that was the night I almost called Anne-Marie Susie. The phone booth across from the lounge was empty. I had a pocket full of change from my latest victory in the Hearts Wars, and I suddenly decided the time had come. I dialed her number from memory, although I had to think for a moment about the last four digits. Were they 8146 or 8164? And plugged in three quarters when the operator asked for them. I let the phone ring a single time, then racked the receiver with a bang and retrieved my quarters when I heard them rattle into the return. A day or two later, shortly before Halloween, Nate got an album by a guy I'd only vaguely heard of, Phil Oakes, a folky, but not the blunk-blunk banjo kind who used to show up on Hootenanny. The album cover, which showed a rumpled troubadour sitting on a curb in New York City, went oddly with the covers of Nate's other records, Dean Martin looking tipsy in a tux, Mitch Miller with his sing-along smile, Diane Renee in her midi blouse and perky sailor cap. The Oaks record was called I Ain't Marchin' Anymore, and Nate played it a lot as the days shortened and turned chilly. I took to playing it myself, and Nate didn't seem to mind. There was a kind of baffled anger in Oaks's voice. I suppose I liked it because most of the time I felt pretty baffled myself. He was like Dylan, but less complicated in his expression and clearer in his rage. The best song on the album, also the most troubling, was the title song. In that song, Oakes didn't just suggest, but came right out and said that war wasn't worth it. War was never worth it. Even when it was worth it, it wasn't worth it. This idea, coupled with the image of young men just walking away from Lyndon and his Vietnam obsession by the thousands and tens of thousands, excited my imagination in a way that had nothing to do with history or policy or rational thought. I must have killed 1 million men, and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore, Phil Oakes sang through the speaker of Nate's nifty little swingline phono. Just quit it, in other words. Quit doing what they say. Quit doing what they want. Quit playing their game. It's an old game, and in this one, the bitch is hunting you. And maybe to show you mean it, you start wearing a symbol of your resistance, something others will first wonder about and then perhaps rally to. It was a couple of days after Halloween that Nate Hoppenstein showed us what the symbol was going to be. Finding out started with one of those crumpled leftover newspapers in the third floor lounge. Son of a bitch, look at this, Billy Marchant said. Harvey Twiller was shuffling the cards at Billy's table. Lenny Doria was adding up the current score, and Billy was taking the opportunity to do a quick scan-through of the news's local section. Kirby McClendon, unshaven, tall and twitchy, well on his way to his date with all those baby aspirants, leaned in to take a look. Billy drew back from him, fluttering a hand in front of his face. Jesus, Kirb, when did you take your last shower? Columbus Day? 4th of July? Let me see, Kirby said, ignoring him. He snatched the paper away. Fuck, that's rip-rip. Ronnie Malenfant got up so fast his chair fell over, entranced by the idea that Stoke had made the paper. When college kids showed up in the Derry News, except on the sports page, of course, it was always because they were in trouble. Others gathered around Kirby, Skip and me among them. It was Stokely Jones III, all right, and not just him. Standing in the background, their faces almost but not quite lost in the clusters of dots. Christ, Skip said. I think that's Nate. He sounded amused and astonished. And that's Carol Gerber just up ahead of him, I said in a funny, shocked voice. I knew the jacket with Harwich High School on the back, knew the blonde hair hanging over the jacket's collar in a ponytail, knew the faded jeans. And I knew the face. Even half turned away and shadowed by a sign reading, U.S. out of Vietnam now, I knew the face. That's my girlfriend. It was the first time the word girlfriend had come out of my mouth tied to Carol's name, although I had been thinking of her that way for a couple of weeks at least. Police break up draft protest, the photo caption read. No names were given. According to the accompanying story, a dozen or so protesters from the University of Maine had gathered in front of the federal building in downtown Derry. They had carried signs and marched around the entrance to the Selective Service Office for about an hour, singing songs and chanting slogans, some obscene. Police had been called and had at first only stood by, intending to allow the demonstration to run its course. But then an opposing group of demonstrators had turned up, mostly construction workers on their lunch break. They had begun chanting their own slogans, and although the news didn't mention if they were obscene or not, I could guess there had been invitations to go back to Russia, suggestions as to where the demonstrators could store their signs while not in use, and directions to the nearest barber shop. When the protesters began to shout back at the construction workers, and the construction workers began firing pieces of fruit from their dinner buckets at the protesters, the police had stepped in. Citing the protesters' lack of a permit, the Derry cops had apparently never heard about the right of Americans to assemble peaceably, they rounded up the kids and took them to the police substation on Wycham Street. There they were simply released. We only wanted to get them out of a bad atmosphere, one cop was quoted as saying. If they go back down there, they're even dumber than they look. The photo really wasn't much different from the one taken at East Annex during the Coleman Chemicals protest. It showed the cops leading the protesters away while construction workers, a year or so later, they would all be sporting small American flags on their hard hats, jeered and grinned and shook their fists. One cop was frozen in the act of reaching out toward Carol's arm. Nate, standing behind her, had not attracted their attention, it seemed. Two more cops were escorting Stoke Jones, who was back to the camera but unmistakable on his crutches. If any further aid to identification was needed, there was that hand-drawn sparrow track on his jacket.
"Look at that dumb fuck," Ronnie crowed.
Ronnie, who had flunked 2 of 4 on the last round of prelims, had a nerve calling anyone a dumb fuck.
"Like he didn't have anything better to do."
Skip ignored him. So did I. For us, Ronnie's bluster was already fading into insignificance, no matter what the subject. We were fascinated by the sight of Carol and of Nate Hoppenstand behind her, watching as the demonstrators were led away. Nate, as neat as ever, in an Ivy League shirt and jeans with cuffs and creases. Nate standing near the jeering, fist-shaking construction workers, but totally ignored by them. Ignored by the cops, too. Neither group knew my roommate had lately become a fan of the subversive Mr. Phil Oakes. I slipped out to the telephone booth and called Franklin Hall, second floor. Someone from the lounge answered, and when I asked for Carol, the girl said Carol wasn't there. She'd gone over to the library to study with Libby Sexton. "Is this Pete?"
"Yeah," I said.
"There's a note here for you. She left it on the glass." This was common practice in the dorms at that time. "It says she'll call you later."
"Okay, thanks."
Skip was outside the telephone booth, motioning impatiently for me to come. We walked down the hall to see Nate, even though we knew we'd both lose our places at the tables where we'd been playing. In this case, curiosity outweighed obsession. Nate's face didn't change much when we showed him the paper and asked him about the demonstration the day before, but his face never changed much. All the same, I sensed that he was unhappy, perhaps even miserable. I couldn't understand why that would be. Everything had ended well, after all. No one had gone to jail or even been named in the paper. I just about decided I was reading too much into his usual quietness when Skip said, "What's eating you?" There was a kind of rough concern in his voice. Nate's lower lip trembled and then firmed at the sound of it. He leaned over the neat surface of his desk. My own was already covered in about 19 layers of junk, and snagged a Kleenex from the box he kept by his record player. He blew his nose long and hard. When he was finished, he was under control again, but I could see the baffled unhappiness in his eyes. Part of me, a mean part, was glad to see it. Glad to know that you didn't have to turn into a hearts junkie to have problems. Human nature can be so shitty sometimes. I rode up with Stoke and Harry Swidrowski and a few other guys, Nate said. "Was Carol with you?" I asked. Nate shook his head. "I think she was with George Gilman's bunch. There were 5 carloads of us in all." I didn't know George Gilman from Adam, but that did not prevent me from directing a dart of fairly sick jealousy at him. "Harry and Stoke are on the Committee of Resistance. Gilman, too. Anyway, we..."
"Committee of Resistance?" Skip asked. "What's that?"
"A club," Nate said and sighed. "They think it's something more, especially Harry and George. They're real firebrands. But it's just another club, really, like the main mask or the pep squad." Nate said he himself had gone along because it was a Tuesday and he didn't have any classes on Tuesday afternoons. No one gave orders. No one passed around loyalty oaths or even sign-up sheets. There was no real pressure to march, and none of the paramilitary beret-wearing fervor that crept into the anti-war movement later on. Carol and the kids with her had been laughing and bopping each other with their signs when they left the gym parking lot, according to Nate. Laughing. Laughing with George Gilman. I threw another of those germ-laden jealousy darts. When they got to the federal building, some people demonstrated, marching around in circles in front of the Selective Service office door, and some people didn't. Nate was one of those who didn't. As he told us that, his usually smooth face tightened in another brief cramp of something that might have been real misery in a less settled boy. "I meant to march with them," he said. "All the way up, I expected to march with them. It was exciting, six of us crammed into Harry Swidrowski's Saab, a real trip. Hunter McPhail, do you guys know him?" Skip and I shook our heads. I think both of us were a little awestruck to discover the owner of Meet Trini Lopez and Diane Renee Sings Navy Blue had what amounted to a secret life, including connections to the sort of people who attracted both cops and newspaper coverage. He and George Gilman started the committee. Anyway, Hunter was holding Stokes' crutches out the window of the Saab because we couldn't fit them inside, and we sang, "I Ain't Marching Anymore," and talked about how maybe we could really stop the war if enough of us got together. That is, all of us talked about stuff like that except Stoke. He keeps pretty quiet. So, I thought, even with them, he keeps quiet. Except, presumably, when he decides a little credibility lecture is in order. But Nate wasn't thinking about Stoke. Nate was thinking about Nate, brooding over his feet's inexplicable refusal to carry his heart where it had clearly wanted to go. All the way up, I'm thinking, I'll march with them. I'll march with them because it's right. At least, I think it's right. And if someone takes a swing at me, I'll be nonviolent, just like the guys in the lunchroom sit-ins. Those guys won, maybe we can win, too. He looked at us. I mean, it was never a question in my mind, you know? Yeah, Skip said. I know. But when we got there, I couldn't do it. I helped hand out signs saying stop the war and U.S. out of Vietnam now and bring the boys home. Carol and I helped Stoke fix his so he could march with it and still use his crutches. But I couldn't take one myself. I stood on the sidewalk with Bill Shadwick and Carrie Morin and a girl named Lorley McGinnis. She's my partner in botany lab. He took the sheet of newspaper out of Skip's hand and studied it, as if to confirm again that, yes, it had all really happened. The master of Rinty and the boyfriend of Cindy had actually gone to an anti-war demonstration. He sighed and then let the piece of newspaper drift to the floor. This was so unlike him, it kind of hurt my head. I thought I would march with them. I mean, why else did I come? All the way down from Orono, it was never, you know, a question in my mind. He looked at me, kind of pleading. I nodded as if I understood. But then I didn't. I don't know why. Skip sat down next to him on his bed. I found the Phil Oakes album and put it on the turntable. Nate looked at Skip, then looked away. Nate's hands were as small and neat as the rest of him, except for the nails. The nails were ragged, bitten right down to the quick. "Okay," he said, as if Skip had asked out loud. "I do know why. I was afraid they'd get arrested, and I'd get arrested with them. That my picture would be in the paper getting arrested and my folks would see it." There was a long pause. Poor old Nady was trying to say the rest. I held the needle over the first groove of the spinning record, waiting to see if he could. At last, he did. "That my mother would see it." "It's okay, Nate," Skip said. "I don't think so," Nate replied in a trembling voice. "I really don't." He wouldn't meet Skip's eyes, only sat there on his bed with his prominent chicken ribs and bare white Yankee skin between his pajama bottoms and his freshman beanie, looking down at his gnawed cuticles. "I don't like to argue about the war. Harry does, and Lorley, George Gilman, gosh, you can't get George to shut up about it, and most of the others on the committee are the same. But when it comes to talking, I'm more like Stoke than them." "No one's like Stoke," I said. I remembered the day I met him on Bennett's Walk. "Why don't you take it easy?" I'd asked. "Why don't you eat me?" Mr. Credibility had replied. Nate was still studying his cuticles. "What I think is that Johnson is sending American boys over there to die for no reason. It isn't imperialism or colonialism like Harry Swidrowski believes. It's not any ism at all. Johnson's got it all mixed up in his mind with Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone and the New York Yankees, that's all. And if I think that, I ought to say that. I ought to try to stop it. That's what I learned in church, in school, even in the darn Boy Scouts of America. You're supposed to stand up. If you see something happening that's wrong, like a big guy beating up a little guy, you're supposed to stand up and at least try to stop it. But I was afraid my mother'd see a picture of me getting arrested and cry. Nate raised his head, and we saw he was crying himself. Just a little. Wet lids and lashes, no more than that. For him, it was a big deal, though. I found out one thing, he said. What that is on the back of Stoke Jones's jacket. What? Skip asked. A combination of two British Navy semaphore letters. Look. Nate stood up with his bare heels together. He lifted his left arm straight up toward the ceiling and dropped his right down to the floor, making a straight line. That's in. Next, he held his arms out at 45-degree angles to his body. I could see how the two shapes, when superimposed, would make the shape Stoke had inked on the back of his old duffel coat. This one's D. N-D, Skip said. So? The letters stand for Nuclear Disarmament. Bertrand Russell invented the symbol in the 50s. He drew it on the back of his notebook. He called it a peace sign. Cool, Skip said. Nate smiled and wiped under his eyes with his fingers. That's what I thought, he agreed. It's a groove thing. I dropped the needle on the record, and we listened to Phil Oakes sing, groove to it, as we Atlanteans used to say. The lounge in the middle of Chamberlain 3 had become my Jupiter, a scary planet with a huge gravitational pull. Still, I resisted it that night, slipping back into the phone booth instead and calling Franklin again. This time, I got Carol. I'm all right, she said, laughing a little. I'm fine. One of the cops even called me Little Lady. Sheesh, Pete, such concern. How much concern did this guy Gilman show you? I felt like asking. But even at 18, I knew that wasn't the way to go. You should have given me a call, I said. Maybe I would have gone with you. We could have taken my car. Carol began to giggle, a sweet sound, but puzzling. What? I was thinking about riding to an anti-war demonstration in a station wagon with a Goldwater sticker on the bumper. I guess that was sort of funny. Besides, she said, I imagine you had other things to do. What's that supposed to mean? As if I didn't know. Through the glass of the phone booth and that of the lounge, I could see most of my floor mates playing cards in a fume of cigarette smoke. And even in here, with the door closed, I could hear Ronnie Malenfant's high-pitched cackle. We're chasing the bitch, boys. We are churchaying la cunt noire, and we're going to have her out of the bushes. Studying her hearts, she said. Studying, I hope. One of the girls on my floor goes out with Lenny Doria, or did when he still had time to go out. She calls it the card game from hell. Am I being a nag yet? No, I said, not knowing if she was or not. Maybe I needed to be nagged. Carol, are you okay? There was a long pause. Yeah, she said at last. Sure I am. The construction workers who showed up, mostly mouth, she said. Don't worry, really. But she didn't sound right to me, not quite right, and there was George Gilman to worry about. I worried about him in a way I didn't about Sully, the boyfriend back home. Are you on this committee Nate told me about, I asked her. This committee of resistance, what's it? No, she said. Not yet, at least. George has asked me to join.
He's this guy from my poli-sci course, George Gilman. Do you know him?
Heard of him, I said. I was clutching the phone too tightly and couldn't seem to loosen up.
He was the one who told me about the demonstration. I rode up with him and some others.
She broke off for a moment, then said with honest curiosity,
"You're not jealous of him, are you?"
"Well," I said carefully, "he got to spend an afternoon with you. I'm jealous of that, I guess."
"Don't be. He's got brains, plenty of them, but he's also got a whiffle haircut and great big shifty eyes. He shaves, but it seems like he always misses a big patch. He's not the attraction, believe me."
"Then what is?"
"Can I see you? I want to show you something. It won't take long, but it might help if I could just explain."
Her voice wavered on the word, and I realized she was close to tears.
"What's wrong?"
"You mean, other than that my father probably won't let me back into his house once he's seen me in the news? He'll have the locks changed by this weekend, I'll bet. That's if he hasn't changed them already."
I thought of Nate saying he was afraid his mother would see a picture of him getting arrested. Mommy's good little pre-dent pinched down in Derry for parading in front of the federal building without a permit. Ah, the shame, the shame.
And Carol's dad?
Not quite the same deal, but close. Carol's dad was a steady boy who said ship ahoy and joined the Navy, after all.
"He may not see the story," I said. "Even if he does, the paper didn't use any names."
"The picture." She spoke patiently, as if to someone who can't help being dense. "Didn't you see the picture?"
I started to say that her face was mostly turned away from the camera, and what you could see was in shadow. Then I remembered her high school jacket with Harwich High School blaring across the back. Also, he was her father, for Christ's sake. Even half turned away from the camera, he would know her.
"He may not see the picture either," I said lamely. "Damerscott is at the far edge of the news's area."
"Is that how you want to live your life, Pete?" She still sounded patient, but now it was patience with an edge. "Doing stuff and then hoping people won't find out?"
"No," I said. And could I get mad at her for saying that, considering that Anne-Marie Soucie still didn't have the slightest idea that Carol Gerber was alive?
I didn't think so. Anne-Marie and I weren't married or anything, but marriage wasn't the issue.
"No, I don't. But Carol, you don't have to shove the damn newspaper under his nose for him, do you?"
She laughed. The sound had none of the brightness I had heard in her earlier giggle, but I thought even a rueful laugh was better than none at all.
"I won't have to. He'll find it. That's just the way he is. But I had to go, Pete. And I'll probably join the Committee of Resistance, even though George Gilman always looks like a little kid who just got caught eating boogers and Harry Swidrowski has the world's worst breath. Because it's... the thing of it is... you see..."
She blew a frustrated, I can't explain sigh into my ear.
"Listen, you know where we go out for smoke breaks?
At Holyoke?
By the dumpster, sure."
"Meet me there," Carol said. "In 15 minutes, can you?"
"Yes. I have a lot more studying to do, so I can't stay long, but I just...
I'll be there."
I hung up the phone and stepped out of the booth. Ashley Rice was standing in the doorway of the lounge, smoking and doing a little shuffle step. I deduced that he was between games. His face was too pale, the black stubble on his cheek standing out like pencil marks, and his shirt had gone beyond simply soiled. It looked lived in. He had a wide-eyed danger, high-voltage look that I later came to associate with heavy cocaine users. And that's what the game really was, a kind of drug. Not the kind that mellowed you out, either.
"What do you say, Pete?" he asked. "Want to play a few hands?"
"Maybe later," I said, and started down the hall. Stoke Jones was thumping back from the bathroom in an old frayed robe. His crutches left round tracks on the linoleum. His hair was wet, crazier than ever. I wondered how he did in the shower. Certainly there were none of the railings and grab handles that later became standard in public washing facilities. He didn't look as though he would much enjoy discussing the subject, however. That or any other subject.
"How you doing, Stoke?" I asked. He went by without answering, head down, dripping hair plastered to his cheeks, soap and towel clamped under one arm, muttering rip, 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 rip under his breath. He never even looked up at me. Say whatever you wanted about Stoke Jones, you could depend on him to put a little fuck you into your day.